What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Stretch 4 podcast. I'm your host, Peter Tran, and on the line, I got my pick-and-pop partner, Josh Cohen. How you doing?
Doing as well as the Raptors right now, I suppose.
Yeah, that's sad, man. Well, you got to bring that up. You had a whole weekend to get through it and still moping around here.
Funerals are tough.
No kidding. A banger in the paint, Rojan Walia. How you feeling, man?
You know what? I was sad about the Raptors for around 24 hours, and then you just got to keep it moving. So we have a lot to talk about.
It was a pretty big weekend for my high Nuggets, guys. We're still alive, down 3-1 against the LA Clippers. And these guys just, man, they love fighting from a deficit. The second round, they've pushed it to 7 games. This makes it 4 series in a row now. If you remember last year, they went to 7 against the Spurs and then against the Trailblazers. And then this year against the Jazz, obviously narrowly surviving by a blown Torrey Craig layup and a Mike Conley shot that was barely out of the net. And now they survived again. 2 straight games, games 5 and 6, they were down by 16 and 18 points respectively. A lot of second half comebacks. We were looking at a lot of picking on Montrezl Harrell and Lou Williams when they're on the floor. And my God, guys, we got ourselves a Game 7 once again.
We're going to Game 7, baby! Game 7! Game 7!
Hey, you know what? If it brought them to a Game 7 in a series that they had no business being in, then I'm all for it. But to answer your question, I think the Nuggets have a chance in this game because the way they've actually came back in this series, they were down 3-1. They blew a pretty big lead, actually, in game 3. And that was a game that they let slip. And they've been fighting back from, I think, 16-point deficits and a 19-point deficit. And the way they're doing it is surprising because I never gave the Nuggets a chance. I thought this was going 5 games. Maybe 6 if the Nuggets really got lucky. But you know what? Jokic is right. They're playing with house money and all the pressure is on the Clippers. So can the Nuggets do it? Absolutely. Will they is a different question, though.
Yeah, I think this comes down to adjustments and if Doc Rivers is willing to make the hard decision, because I think we all know what the hard decision is, and it's whether or not he's going to play Montrezl Harrell in the next game. And how much he plays him, really, because in the minutes that he played, I think there was like a 5-minute stretch where they went minus 15 or something like that when he's playing against Jokic. And that's been pretty consistent the last couple of games. And he just hasn't looked the same. Like, normally he's a beast inside, providing some scoring even if he's not defending as well. And, you know, the last couple of games, obviously, he hasn't looked like that. Or hasn't really looked like that since he got back. He's been looking like he's out of shape. And, Jermichael Green played really well in the last game. And Zubac has been pretty good in the 25 to 30 minutes of game that he's played. So will he make the tough decision? Will he shorten his rotation a little bit too if, you know, Lou Williams is not playing too well and still bricking 24 threes in a row? I don't know. Doc hasn't really proven that, you know, himself to be a guy that makes big-time adjustments when it matters, seeing as he's lost 2-3-1 series already in the past with Orlando and then with the Clippers. So it should be interesting to see if he makes that tough decision or not.
Are we calling him the Coach Budenholzer of the West right now?
Yeah, it's looking that way, honestly.
I wouldn't go that far because I think Mike Budenholzer like makes no adjustments, period. And I think the difference too is the Clippers are in these games, like they're in winning positions and they're just throwing away the lead compared to Budenholzer, which is a whole different story about not putting his players in the best position to succeed. And so I wouldn't go that far, but I think losing 2-3-1 leads, it's definitely sitting in the Clippers' mind that the fact that the last 2 games, they should have put Denver away.
Yeah, I found a stat that was, you know, pretty interesting in this respect. So Josh, you're talking about how Jokic is just dominating Montrezl Harrell. He's shooting 70.6% against Montrezl Harrell alone. 70%. And then against Zubac, it's like 47, which is, you know, still pretty damn good, but it's nowhere at 70%. Like, that is a disgusting number. Harrell has no chance against this guy. He's smaller than him. He's getting bullied. And frankly, he's not providing the same type of energy that we expected out of him basically all season, right? Like, the six-man duo, quote-unquote, that we had of Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell running their pick-and-roll offense is nowhere to be found. Lou Williams can't buy a shot. Harrell, we just talked about, is a ghost. And last game, Doc actually brought JaMychal Green out first before Montrezl Harrell. He literally replaced his six-man of the year with a different six-man. So, I don't know, man. Going forward, I wouldn't be surprised if Harrell played maybe 10 minutes next game while Jokic is out. You try to match up those minutes, and then if he's not playing well, then you might just have to sit him and just run Green out there for majority of the time that Zubac isn't on.
Yeah, you might have to treat him as if he's Eddie House circa 2006, and if he comes in the game hot and he's scoring a few baskets in the paint, then you keep him out there, and if he doesn't, then you know, you bring in JaMychal Green and then maybe extend Zubac's minutes. But I just found it funny that, you know, in the first quarter, I think it was, where Montrezl Harrell scored maybe his only basket of the game. It was a post-up against Jokic. He posted him up underneath the basket, and he scored. And then afterwards, he's, like, talking his usual junk like he normally does after every basket. And Nikola just smiled at him. And then you see later in the game, like, Harrell doesn't score the rest of the game, I don't believe. And then Jokic, he obviously went off in the third and fourth quarter, and that shot that he hit against Paul George, and the little smirk that he gave him, it's like the perfect, you know, perfect opposite effect right there with Jokic versus Harrell. And just, he just goes about his business and does his thing very quietly. He's a quiet guy, obviously. He's not a guy that wants to be in the limelight, it seems like, but, you know, his game does all the talking.
Montrezl Harrell had 5 points for that game. A whole 5 points. So how do you try to slow down? How do you try to slow down this combination of Jokic and Murray, especially in the second half? Right, like, I think something that no one is really focusing on is that the Clippers go out to big leads. Like, Raj, you talked about it earlier. They were up 18, 16 in each of these games. It's not like they were always down. But they sort of just let their pulled the foot off the gas? That's a thing, right? They stopped pressuring, right? They just got lazy. They weren't rotating properly. They weren't looking for backdoor cuts. And everything was just, like, a step slower. They were just chilling, basically. As soon as that second half hit, like, nothing was clicking for them. And then, you know, Denver gets a couple of easy buckets here and there. They let Paul Millsap have a resurgence. Paul Millsap hasn't been seen in the NBA since, like, March. And somehow he blew them up in two games in a row. My God. What do you do just to stay focused at this point?
Yeah, like, with the Clippers, I think the issue is really on the defensive side of the ball. And if they do a better job in the second half, I think they will be okay on the offensive end. And I think the issue is because whoever they put on Jokic, particularly if it's not Zubac, isn't comfortable playing with a playmaker. And then they always have to double, and then they always have to end up being in rotations. And you just saw it late in the game that Jokic was just getting the ball. And if they're doing a pick and roll with Jamal Murray, Jokic would be the man who would just step out, and Harrell was uncomfortable. He was just standing back and giving Jokic the open three, which we've now seen that Jokic is very comfortable hitting. And then if Jokic ends up getting the ball a bit deeper, Harrell's just not strong enough or tall enough to contend with him, and they have to send the double, and Jokic is talented enough to find the man out there. So I think what the Clippers really have to do in this case is to make Jokic, either if he gets the ball in the exterior, not to let him get open shots. So they can't have the whoever's guarding Jokic to drop off and give him open threes. And when they get him in the paint, I think you need to be faster on rotations and know that Jokic, whenever he gets the ball, is always going to pass out, and he's looking for a three-point shot.
I mean, to bring it all full circle here, they need to do what the Raptors do. I mean, going back to, we talked about Kawhi, obviously. He should have stayed in Toronto, first of all. But second of all, what the Clippers need to do is they need to junk up their defense and maybe play some zones against Denver. Just get them guessing, like, because they got way too comfortable in the second half, especially. They started playing, you know, Denver Nuggets circa, you know, regular season basketball, zipping the ball around the perimeter. A lot of guys were getting open shots. Gary Harris hit a couple threes down the stretch. You know, Torrey Craig hit a three. He got a couple of nice cuts as well. You know, Jeremy Grant wasn't shooting as much this game, but he was pretty effective overall. So they just need to do something to make the Nuggets more uncomfortable, because they seem to have figured out some things, especially, you know, getting Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell involved with every play when they're on the court. So they need to throw some, maybe, you know, some 1-1-3 zones out there, box and ones, whatever they need to do to try to limit Murray and Jokic especially, and try to get Jeremy Grant shooting 13 to 14 times a game like the last, a couple of games that the Clippers won.
It's difficult at this point to run out those type of defenses though, right? I think that's one of the things that we got to commend the Raptors for, is that Coach Nurse was making the guys literally practice box and ones throughout the season. It's not something that he just like whipped up out of nowhere and like the whole team just caught on immediately. So to come up with like different defenses like that, it's kind of tough. Well, obviously in the Game 7 situation especially.
Yeah, and I think another thing the Clippers have to remind themselves is that Denver is only really doing this in the second half. So in the first half, something is working for them, or Denver's just hitting no shots in the first half, which I kind of find that hard to believe considering that Denver in this series has been a better second half team than the Clippers. But I think what they have to do is either make Jokic have to make more difficult reads, because like Josh mentioned, they're kind of figuring it out, how the switches are working, how to get Jokic on a smaller defender, and then when the help comes, who's going to be open. And that's a bit easy for Denver now, and I think what the Clippers need to do is give a few different looks. And I really do think that if they play to their capacity, that they'll be able to shut down the Nuggets, and the Nuggets won't score like 60 points and a half.
I think that one thing they could do that we sort of saw down the stretch of the game is they could put either Paul George or Kawhi on Jokic, and then put the other guy of those two on Murray, and then you just switch the pick and rolls. And then if Jokic eventually gets the ball in the post or at the high post, with, you know, 10 seconds or less on the clock, you just throw a double at him, and then you just rotate around the perimeter, as long as you don't have a guy like Montrezl Harrell out there that can't really rotate as well as the other guys. So I think if Jermichael Green's at center, that's definitely an option you can look at, and just have them zipping around the court, because the Clippers are honestly at their best when they play the small type of lineups where, you know, these guys can zip around the perimeter and force teams into, you know, going into later in the shot clock, and then also forcing turnovers by playing smaller and quicker, because that's their biggest advantage versus the rest of the league really that's left, you know, with Boston and Miami and such. Like, they probably have the best small ball lineup that's left over, having Kawhi and Paul George on the perimeter, and obviously Patrick Beverley when he's not fouling every second minute of the game. So I think that's definitely an option to look out for in Game 7, where they're going to do a lot of switching and forcing Denver late in the clock to have their role players like Craig and, you know, Jeremy Grant and guys off the bench, Harris as well, take threes later in the clock. And if they hit them, they probably win. But, you know, so far we haven't really seen too many games where they have hit them consistently.
We're just in line for another Paul Millsap game. Is that what you're telling me here?
Millsap has his quarters. Did he even score the first half last game? Feels like he hits all of his points in the third quarter.
Not even games or halves, just quarters. He's had two good quarters in the whole series. For coming from Denver's perspective, you know, how do you close out this Game 7? Obviously, they're a team that's, like I said earlier, this is their fourth Game 7 in four series, right? Against Utah, but they obviously went down 3-1. Against LA, they've gone down 3-1. That's five elimination games, this being the sixth that they're going into, and they've somehow survived, right? How do you keep up the pressure? How do you sustain that type of adrenaline, that type of defense, that type of pressure to, you know, put LA in bad positions, to make Patrick Beverley foul out in the first half like he's seemingly doing, or to keep Lou Williams on like a cold shooting streak?
Yeah, I think the one thing that Denver is doing, and I think it's also a bit of how the Clippers offense work, is I think if they allow Paul George and Kawhi to get 20 or 30 points, that's not the end of the world, just because the Clippers play a lot of ISO offense. So they shouldn't get flustered if one of their stars starts taking over. It's really how well one of those stars can get the rest of the team involved, because when Shamit starts hitting some buckets, Marcus Morris, Zubac is getting some easy dunks, that's when they become extremely dangerous. If they're just a strictly ISO team with one of their two stars going off for like 25 or 30, I think Denver shouldn't overreact. And I think another thing too is they just need to play who's hot in terms of their lineup. Like Josh mentioned, Grant wasn't having a good game in game six on the offensive side, and they relied more on Craig and Gary Harris to produce some of the buckets. So I think that's one thing they absolutely have to do is Mike Malone has to go with the hot hand. Like, even if it's not his conventional lineups or if it's the people that expect to play in game seven down the stretch, you got to play who's hot and really use your lineup to your advantage, because they do have a lot of contributors on this team, and they really can go eight or nine deep. And they shouldn't be afraid to do so against the Clippers team just to see who's playing well.
I think no matter what, they need to keep Michael Porter Jr. out there if the game is close and on the line, because this is going to be a really good experience for him, obviously, going forward. And if they want to create what they think they have in a big three going forward, I think the fastest way to do that is to get him these kind of reps, and especially on the defensive end, and having to, you know, guard switches and, you know, rotate on the perimeter in big moments, knowing where to go. So he's only going to be able to do that if he actually plays his fourth quarters. And plus, he's a lot more effective out there in offense than Millsap is, because he has more gravity on offense, and that you have to really, really guard him. And you can't put a guy like Lou Williams on him like they did in game five, where he hit that shot early in the shot clock, because he's too tall, you know, and he's a guy that you have to guard out there. Whereas Millsap takes, you know, 24 seconds to get a shot off. So I think Porter Jr. has to be out there in crunch time, no matter what, if there is a crunch time. But honestly, I think that the Clippers, like the real Clippers, well, I mean, some of the time anyway, are going to come out tomorrow and probably put a statement game out there. And I think that ultimately they're probably going to win, unfortunately. I want to see Jokic in the conference finals, but I don't think it's going to happen.
I want to see Michael Porter Jr. talk shit in the mid-possession after he gets a rebound again. Gets a block shot, gets a rebound, and then just starts talking all his shit before he gets fouled, before there's a whistle, just, you know, out there doing his thing. That kid has a lot of cojones, man. He's a bad MF-er. That's all I can really say. Like, defensively, he's a major liability, but, you know, he's there. He's tall. He has a bit of length. He's like 6'10", right?
Yeah, so. And the weird thing is they haven't really exploited him that much in this series. When you think back to the Utah series and how much they involved him in every single play, the Clippers aren't doing that. Utah involved him in literally every play that he was out there and just exposed him big time. And the minutes that he played, most of the time he was a big minus out there. And you don't really see like Kawhi bringing his guy up just to pick on him, which could be another adjustment for Game 7.
Well, the Clippers don't really run any like screen actions. You know what I mean? Everything is off-ball movement or just penetrate and dish. It's very, like, their offense is super simple. Or realistically, it's Kawhi or PG ISO. Or occasionally the Lou Will PNR with Harrell that, you know, has been, you know, non-existent this whole series. But otherwise, you're looking at super simple offense from this team. Whereas the Jazz had to do anything they could just to buy a bucket. Or at least to get Mitchell somewhat of a shot, right? So it makes more sense that the Jazz had to do it. But the Clippers tend to just use superstar power and rely on it so much more. That being said, you know, it's going to be tough for the Nuggets to win. I hate to say it, but I've been down on them for the past two games. I thought they were going to lose in 5 and 6. So I don't really know where I stand on this game. If they make it, I would love it. I don't know how they would fare against the Lakers and LeBron, because I think LeBron would just, you know, dominate everything because he's LeBron. But it'd be a good storyline, guys. That's all I can really say.
So are we going to make picks here, or are we just going to talk about the game?
Yeah, let's do it. Go ahead. Why don't you start, Russ?
Yeah, all right. So I've been saying this, that the Clippers are the team to beat this year, and I think it's the popular choice with the reigning finals MVP and just how their lineup's constructed. So I'm going to have to double down. I think the Clippers actually finished the Nuggets here. I'm going to give the Nuggets a lot more credit than I have in the past. So I think it'll be a hell of a close game, with the Clippers probably winning by like 5 or 6 points. But the game will always be within reach, like within 5 to 10 points.
I don't think it's going to be that close, unfortunately. I think that the Clippers are going to have a pretty consistent lead over the course of the game. Kawhi is going to do his thing like he always does in game sevens. And, you know, I think he's going to be the best player out there, and that's going to make the difference. And I think the Clippers' defense is going to be on point next game as well. I don't think Jokic is going to be able to, you know, get some of the looks that he was getting, especially with the pick and pops. Like, he gets a lot of open mid-range looks, especially, which he's been knocking down at like a Nowitzki level of the entire playoffs. His shooting has gone up another notch in the playoffs versus the regular season, which is not something anybody really expected. But he's making the most of his looks. But I think ultimately the Clippers are going to win by 12 points, even though I really want to see the Nuggets win now. And the Clippers are 0-7 games to get into the Western Conference Finals, thus the Clippers curse. So, you know, the numbers say they're going to lose, but they are the Clippers of this year, which is a totally different story with Kawhi. So I think they're going to ultimately win this game.
Let's keep up that 0-7 record, man. I like that percentage right now.
The curse of Sterling.
Yo, Clippers culture, man. Full of losers. Ah, screw it. I'm going to go with the Nuggets. What am I doing? Screw you guys, man. I got to ride the team. And they're hot. They're hot. They have nothing. Like, they don't care.
Only in the second half.
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely betting on the Clippers in the first half. There's no doubt. That first quarter is going to be brutal. But, you know, the same thing as usual. Once Paul Millsap wakes up from his, you know, days and a long nap and finally shows up for the game, we'll be good. Hopefully. I don't know, man. This is tough. I really want to see what
the opposite effect happen in Game 7. I want to see the Nuggets go up 15 points in the first half and just reverse course against the Clippers and see if the Clippers actually respond. That'd be awesome.
No, sir. No, sir. I don't want the Clippers to have more adversity. This team is too crazy for it.
So you're choosing the Nuggets to win, but you don't want the Nuggets to have the lead in the first half at all.
Just like a close lead. I don't want like a 12-point lead. I want like two. I need them to feel the pressure. You know what I mean?
No. You know what they need to do? They need to spot them 15 points so the Nuggets feel the pressure in the first quarter and start playing in the first half instead of the second half. So just have the Clippers up 15 points to start the game automatically.
Why don't we just start the game at halftime?
I want to see a full game of the Nuggets being desperate. I don't want to see one half.
Oh, man. Yo, what's smoother, Josh? A Michael Porter Jr. jump shot or a Nikola Jokic sidestep three off of one
Nikola
foot?
Nikola Jokic's sidestep fadeaway from wherever. Oh, my goodness. That shot is so smooth. That one hit over Paul George in the fourth quarter. Man, that was nice.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure if they're smooth, but they look so weird.
I mean, a lot of people describe it as like the old guy in the park that looks like he can't play it, and all of a sudden he shows up and he just destroys everyone there. He's like 40, 45 years old, but he has his like certain spots that he gets to, and he has his very specific shots. Like when we go to the park, there's always like a guy that hits hook shots, and you're like, what the hell? How did you hit a 15-foot hook shot? That's Jokic's like nowadays. Step back fadeaway. Yeah. That's Jokic's like two-step fadeaway where he goes off the wrong foot and barely jumps and shoots it over his head, and it somehow swishes every time.
Remember at the Sportsplex, Josh, there was that old man who would just torch us from mid-range, and we were like, who the hell takes mid-range jumpers? And he would just, like, you know, he was that typical old guy who would show up with like a headband and two wristbands and just chill until he had his open shot, and I was like, what the hell just happened here? He's that guy, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, I saw him before at a different school when I was like younger, when I was like 15, 16, so I knew that guy. He's like in his 50s, and the guy's jacked, and he was just destroying everybody there. It's fun to watch.
Man, that's wild. Mark Jackson called Jokic the guy who shows up at the park wearing a hat and a cigarette in his mouth. I like that description. That's probably the best way to
do it. Sounds about right.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. We just spent like 25 minutes talking about the Nuggets, guys. Can you believe it? This is the most
Clippers.
Nuggets coverage they've ever gotten.
And the
America's
Clippers.
Team.
America's team led by a Serbian and a Canadian.
Exactly.
All right, well, since you two are both Raptors fans, do you want to talk about this Game 7, or should we just go straight to the Eastern Conference Finals preview?
We're going to talk about the Game 7 because we just have to. And I'm going to be quick. I'm going to say that the Raptors played very well this season and postseason. I think, obviously, Pascal Siakam did not have a good series. He really didn't have a great bubble. It's a good learning experience for him. The fact that Pascal Siakam played so bad and they don't really have the, quote, superstar, and they still managed to go to a Game 7 and be within a few possessions of winning that game speaks a lot to the culture they're building there. And with the right free agent moves and offseason, I think they could be pushing again for another, at least Eastern Conference Finals berth. But credit to the Celtics. They're a tough team to beat, and I think you take nothing away from them. It's just the Raptors, in my opinion, choked a bit.
I don't think you can say they choked based on how the series went. I mean, we probably should have been swept, to be honest. OG doesn't hit that crazy shot. And they were just a better team throughout the series overall, too. Like, Marcus Smart kicked our ass throughout the entire series. He turned in, like, the best version of himself, which is almost like Kyle Lowry, basically. And, you know, overall, Boston just played better than us, and they deserve to win. And even though Siakam was absolutely terrible the entire series, honestly, like, he looked like I thought the Clippers were going to make Luka look, just based on the matchup. I thought they were just going to switch everything, and Luka was going to turn the ball over all the time, not be able to get to his spots. And he proved everyone wrong. He just said, you know what, I'm going to get to wherever the hell I want to get to. And that's obviously not where Siakam is at right now, but hopefully with this experience, he'll be able to improve on, you know, portions of his game that he obviously needs improvement on. Like, the biggest thing in his game I think he needs to improve on is just his jump shooting. Because I think that if he's able to get his three-point percentage up and, you know, become more of a threat out there where guys really need to run him off the line, his game going to the basket is very, very good. But if you can lay off him like Brown did a lot of the time where he shot, you know, Siakam shot, what, 4 for 33 the entire series? He can't obviously shoot 12% for a series, but I think it's like the worst in history from what I saw in the stats after the game. So if he's able to get that up and then become more of a threat out there and be able to drive the basket the way he does, he's going to be a real, you know, exciting option for the Raptors going forward. And all the hate that he got online afterwards was just, I mean, I was obviously hating on him, but not to the level that some people did. It was just a bit too much.
I have a question for you guys. I saw a lot of, I'm assuming it was also on Reddit, but a lot of NBA Twitter was saying, or at least Raptors Twitter, which is even, you know, the wilder part of Twitter. They were saying that they wanted to see Pascal benched for Serge Ibaka going down the stretch. How do, like, Raj, would you bench your star player? Like, he is your highest paid player going forward, right? Like, they've committed max money to the guy. They've sort of agreed that they would build the franchise around him going forward. Why would you bench your star player in that kind of situation? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think Nick Nurse was just always hoping that Siakam would get one or two good looks and get going. And it was just like a waiting game. Like, they needed him in that series. They needed him both on the offensive and defensive side of the ball. I do think there were moments where he had maybe one or two straight bad possessions where you could have taken him off the court and put in Ibaka or play small. But I think overall, like, he needs this learning experience, and I don't think it would have changed the outcome. But I do think that Nick Nurse was a bit stubborn in playing Siakam, and overall, he probably could have benefited from taking him off just to relieve the pressure. And also, Ibaka played really well down the stretch, and he was actually visibly pissed off that he wasn't being placed on the court in the last 3 or 4 minutes until really near the end.
I think it was more a defensive thing, because Siakam was pretty good on defense, or very good on defense, up until the fourth quarter, where he got blown by a few times. But overall, Toronto wanted to play the same lineup that they did in the second overtime and have him, you know, essentially be the center at times. OG was the center at times in those lineups, but just being able to switch everything and just be, you know, a terror on the perimeter, basically, even if he's not making plays on offense. So I totally get why Nurse kept him in. Plus, he's supposed to be your superstar player, and getting him this kind of experience as the number one guy was only going to help him, I think. Even though confidence-wise, he's not great right now, especially after getting destroyed in Game 7. I think this is only going to fuel him, because we've already seen where he's come from, you know, being a garbage player, where he would just clean up, you know, underneath the rim in his first couple of years, not be able to handle the ball at all, to where he is now is really incredible at 26 years old. So, you know, as mad as I was after the game at him, and anytime he got the ball in the fourth quarter, I was yelling at my TV. You know, looking at it now, after everything, this is only going to help him moving forward. And, I saw some things after the game with regards to Lowry, where I don't even think he was in the playoffs when he was up until, 26 years old. And everyone thought that he was a choker up until, you know, the last couple of years, obviously, him and DeRozan. And he's proved everyone wrong the last 2 years especially, so why can't Siakam?
Wow, that was a very measured response from you, Josh.
Yeah, I'm a bit impressed.
Yeah, I was expecting more.
I've been thinking a lot about my Raptors and how they're going to get Giannis in a year.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see about that. He had a three-hour conversation with ownership, you know.
We'll get to that in another pod.
Yeah. All right. Do you guys have anything else to say about the Raptors? Can we move on to the actual actual series that we got to talk about here between the Celtics and the Heat. Finally, the coveted matchup between the 4 and 5 seed of the East, what we've all been waiting for. The what Jay King of The Athletic has termed the About That Life Bowl matchup between Marcus Smart and Jimmy Butler. The two best trash talkers in the league right now. We gotta deep dive into these. Okay, Josh, I gotta ask you. You're pretty much a Miami hater. Let's be real. What do you expect out of Miami's offense now that, you know, Boston actually has guys who can defend? Actual perimeter players that will actually run out on the three line instead of just letting them go by. You know, Marvin Williams isn't out there for the Celtics right now.
You know what? As much as I dislike both of these teams, I really think Boston has a clear advantage in the series. I mean, we saw what Miami was sort of did against Milwaukee when they started switching, you know, when Giannis wasn't playing in the game that they won, where Miami couldn't really do a lot when, you know, Milwaukee started switching everything and forcing them into, you know, late shot clock looks. And Boston's going to do that a lot this series, obviously, with how they play, similar to what the Raptors do. And having a bunch of guys around the perimeter that can basically switch everything. And I don't think they're going to get as many calls. Miami's not going to get as many calls with Jimmy Butler going to the rim against experienced guys like Smart and you know, Jaylen Brown that know how to stay away from those types of foul calls. And if you're switching against Miami, you're not giving up as many open three-point looks to guys like Crowder, hit like 6 threes in a couple games in that series. And, you know, Tyler Hero had a couple big games as well. I think they're going to struggle defensively. And I think this series is going to be a very low-scoring series with respect to how we see the game today. It's not going to be in, you know, total line of 220, I don't think. It's going to be, you know, around 200 if you're lucky. So I think there's going to be a lot of really ugly games, sort of like what happened with the Toronto series. But ultimately, I think Boston has a clear advantage with how they play defense. And I think they're going to have more scoring in this series than Miami will. Because Miami's not going to be able to get their secondary scores as many looks with Boston switching so often, or you have to go against Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum late in the clock as a primary ball handler. You're not going to see Goran Dragic scoring 25 points a game this series.
Raj, what do you think about Boston's offense or Boston's ability to handle this offense? Because Josh, I know you alluded to it, like there's going to be a lot of switches, there's going to be a lot of, you know, movement from the perimeter, but you know, Boston is finally going to have to see a team that doesn't have a stagnant offense like the Raptors in the half court, right? Like Miami's offense is solely based on constant movement. There's a lot of exploiting picks set by Bam or vice versa even. And then a lot of backdoor cuts. You know, as much as we see like guys like Duncan Robinson taking long threes all the time, you also see him cutting backdoor a hell of a lot throughout the series, right? So Raj, like how do you make sure that, you know, you can contain Miami's three-point shooting in that sense?
Yeah, I think when I look at these two teams, like they're actually similar in one respect in the sense that they don't play with set positions. They kind of play with skill sets. And a lot of these pieces are interchangeable. And when I compare the two teams, Boston just a more athletic team. And their players can play multiple styles. And I think on the defensive end, Boston has that flexibility. Like they can switch and they match up well with how Miami plays, because I don't think Miami can get those open looks. Like I don't think Duncan Robinson is going to be able to run off screens and get clean looks at the basket. I don't think his cuts he's not going to be left as open on his cuts. And I think a lot of their offense is going to rely on Butler or Dragic really playmaking and creating shots. And because of that, I don't think Miami is in pole position to win this series. I think they're going to struggle a bit on offense. And on defense, I think they're very versatile. But I think the problems that Boston can pose, especially with Hayward coming back, and then you have three players that can get to the rim, that can shoot pretty consistently, and who can get others involved in Tatum, Brown, and Hayward, will be a nightmare, because I don't see Robinson being able to keep up with those guys. And even though Crowder's a good defender, I think against Tatum he would struggle a bit. And I don't think Hero will be able to keep up defensively against the attacking prowess of Boston. So I think Boston has a clear advantage just because they're better athletes and better skill set.
Wow, you guys are really underestimating Miami's defense, man. How disrespectful of Duncan Robinson. This guy's got like a 6'10 wingspan. And you don't think he can handle Gordon Hayward coming off like a grade 2 ankle sprain? Are you serious?
I'm dead
Come
serious.
Come on. No way, man. You guys are bugging. You don't think that Jay Crowder can stay with Jason Tatum? I'm not saying he's going to stop him, but you don't think he can stay next to him while he's shooting?
He can definitely stay next to him, but I think will he cause as much problems with his length? No, because Tatum's, I think, going to have that advantage.
Yeah, but he's going to bump him. It's not like he's not getting open looks, man. You're acting as if he's just going to elevate straight over Crowder and he's not going to be, you know, anywhere in the scene. That's what I don't understand. Like, Miami's going to have some issues with this team. You're right, because they played against an awful Milwaukee offense and an Indiana offense that was based around Malcolm Brogdon doing whatever he could on the floor alone. Right? So in that sense, Miami is obviously going against the best offense that they've faced, like, throughout the playoffs so far. But that defense is tight, man. These guys are working, like, they're on a string. Like, rotations are good. They have Bam in the center, which is probably the best remaining center other than Anthony Davis and Jokic. So, in other words, he's the better center of the two the East right now.
He's the best center in the East.
Yeah. Come on. I don't buy it. I don't buy this Miami hate.
No, I'm not hating on Miami. I think Miami will be close in the games, and they'll be fun games to watch. I'm really looking forward to tomorrow afternoon or Tuesday in the evening. But I think overall, when kind of looking at the matchups and how dynamic their scores are and how their defense works, I think Boston has great individual defenders. I think Miami's team defense is better, but I think the individual defenders on Boston match up pretty well with Miami's offense. And I think offensively, Boston can just cause a lot of problems because they have multiple players that can get multiple different looks. Like, they're not like, not to say Miami's a one-trick pony, but they can beat you in several different ways, where I think Miami has to shoot the ball really well to beat Boston.
I think the only way that Miami is going to be able to get really good looks and actually win the series is, you know, a guy we haven't really talked about too much so far. It is Bam, right? Because when they run his high post splits, where he's in the high post, going triple handoff or, you know, pick and roll with, you know, Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero, Jimmy Butler, or he's the primary ball handler, getting these guys the ball first, getting them off movement instead of just stagnant offense where they're just going high pick and roll where Boston can switch everything. If he's, you know, creating different advantages by either slipping to the basket and creating a 4-on-3 or just a wide open dunk, and he's handling the ball more and being really effective in that scenario, then Miami has a chance this series. But I think if Miami is just running a lot of their regular stuff, especially in the fourth quarter where Butler's just going pick and roll late in the clock, and then, you know, maybe Tice isn't out there and Boston's playing super small with Tatum at center, I think that Miami's really going to struggle. So I think if you look at Bam's stat lines throughout the series, I think you'll know whether or not Miami won the game. I think he's the key to the series for sure.
So what you guys are talking about initially with Boston is, you know, an offense that revolves around two main guys. You know, you're looking at Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, right? Hopefully Kemba can get his rhythm back. I mean, against Toronto, Kemba was basically shut down because of the box and ones primarily. And then what? Are we expecting Marcus Smart to have another hot series? Like, do we really expect Marcus Smart to hit around 40 to 50% of his threes again? Because for Boston's offense to actually flow and to work against his defense, he has to hit shots. Or one of those two players has to hit shots, right?
Yeah.
Gosh, why are you looking at me like that, man?
Necessarily.
What do you mean?
You know, Kemba Walker was basically a non-factor in the entire Toronto series because they played a box at one against him to totally take him out of the series, right? In some games, he only took, what, 6 shots? The double overtime game, he was 1-for-6, I think, right?
Yeah.
So he's going to be a lot more effective and aggressive this series with the way Miami plays him. Unless Coach Spoelstra just decides to play the exact same junk defense, which is definitely possible.
Well, that's the thing. Miami, during the season, had like one of the best zone defenses of all of the teams. But then in the playoffs, they haven't used it at all, right? It's one of those things I think that Spoelstra has just sort of kept locked in the chamber for a series like this where he would actually need to use it against a team full of shooters. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Kemba didn't get any good flow. Also, you know, Kemba hasn't been this far in the playoffs. All right, like we talk about Kemba as if he's this, you know, I'm not saying he's not a great player. He's an amazing player to watch, but he's never been this far. He never made it to the second round before either. So I'm not really convinced that Kemba's going to go anywhere further than this. You know what I mean?
Honestly, I think his worst performance would have been the Raptors series. Like, I'm not saying he's going to average 22 or 23 this series, but I think he will be a bit more effective than he was against the Raptors. And again, Hayward coming back is going to be big. I don't expect him to play in game one, but I think around game three is when he'll probably be considered. And of course, I'm not expecting him to come back in regular season or mid-season form. But again, I think Boston can get enough scoring from their four or five starters. And again, Josh mentioned this, Miami, the way they play and the way Boston matches up, they're going to be playing at Boston's pace, and they're going to be lower scoring games, probably playing into the 90s. And I think Boston just has a bit better closers, a bit better players who can get their own shots when the defenses are locked in.
I really want to see Bam take another step and become a superstar type center, putting up crazy stats in this series, putting up like 20 and 16 with 7 assists a game, because that's what's going to take for Miami to win the series, I think. I don't think it's going to be Jimmy Butler going for 30. I think it's going to be Bam just putting the beating on Boston's interior. That's something that Toronto didn't do enough of. I mean, Serge Ibaka had a lot of good looks in the paint where he knocks them down, but just not enough overall, whereas Bam's a guy that really attacks the rim, whereas Serge goes with those little hook shots from 5 feet. So if Bam's able to get, you know, a lot of players in foul trouble too, that could also swing the series. So ultimately, I do think it's going to come down to this total. I think if it's over 5 in a lot of these games, I think Miami's going to win. But ultimately, if it's below that point, they're not involving them enough, or if Boston decides just to sort of take them away, if that's even possible, then I think Boston's going to win the series pretty easily.
Attacking the rim is a young man's game, Josh. That's why Serge can't do it anymore. It's hard on those 45-year-old knees, you know?
Yeah, but when he did it, he was very effective. He had some crazy scoring games and super efficient games as well. It's too bad Marc Gasol couldn't do the same thing.
See?
Also, might be talking about the Raptors.
I told you the Raptors should have played Serge Ibaka over Pascal Siakam going down the stretch. God.
All right, Raptors Republic.
All right, so give me your quick predictions, guys. Raj, I know you like the Celtics. Give me the numbers.
Yeah, I'm leaning towards, I really want to say 5 games, but I don't want to disrespect Miami and their effort, so I'm going to say Boston in 6.
Jay?
I have the same prediction, honestly, but I don't know. I'm starting to talk myself into this whole Bam thing, so maybe I'll switch my prediction up.
Oh.
No. Stay with Boston, man. I'm on this Miami train. You can stick to your Celtics. They agree.
I'm really hoping like there is a team of the bubble. I really want to see either like Miami or Denver win the championship and just prove everyone wrong. But ultimately, I'll go with my gut and say Celtics in 6.
Imagine a Denver-Miami finals. How low of ratings would that get?
Woo. Pretty low.
That'd be the worst. Jesus. Give me Miami in 6, man. I'm taking it. I like this team. You guys are underestimating these guys. Tyler Hero's going to hit a game winner once. Just watch. That kid, speaking of Michael Porter cojones factor, Tyler Hero, even bigger cojones, man.
Yeah, and he has a better head on his shoulders than Michael Porter, but we'll save that for another day as well.
It's because he's got a do-rag on his head.
I can't swim, so I
can't
no
swim
reason.
Either.
You can't swim?
Uh-uh.
Oh, you got hood tendencies, man. You would run with us. Give me some.
You got hood tendencies.
He's got those hood.
You know, I really hope that you're right, because I really don't like Boston. So if they lose in this round, I'll be very happy.
Boston was my pick to come out of the East, so I'm sticking with it. One last thing before we wrap up. I want to go into the hypotheticals, because when we pod next, the Western Conference Finals would have started. Who do we think wins this Lakers-Clippers, and in how many games, if it's that's the matchup?
Whoever is playing the Lakers is going to win in 6 games.
Okay, I'm going to say if it's the Clippers, it's going to be 6 games for the Clippers in 6. And then if it's the Nuggets, I will say Nuggets in 7, because I'm staying on the anti-LeBron train.
Wow.
Actually, Nuggets in 7, because they only play a 7-game series. I forgot
there
about
you
that.
Go.
Yeah.
Way to stay consistent, guys. Well, I'm going to tell you this now. The Lakers are missing their second best option because Russell Westbrook isn't on the floor anymore.
Well done.
How about that?
I'd love to go back to the podcast in the summer about that trade and see who was on my side saying that trade was a total heist for OKC.
Dude.
They got the better player and two picks.
No one liked that trade for Houston, okay? Only Houston fans liked that trade for Houston. And even then, they probably hated it.
I remember having some discussions with at least one of you about who was the better player between Paul and Westbrook. I think that was proven this year. Again.
It might have been me. There's a real chance that it was me, but, you know, there was no way that Houston won. Like, there was no way the Harden-Westbrook combination was going to work. And then, you know, I know we didn't touch on this, but just, like, to go through it quickly, Westbrook was literally the Lakers' best option, right? Between his quad injury, missing time at the beginning of the bubble, and, you know, having to deal with COVID. You don't really know how he recovered after that. That dude was in shit shape. I'm giving him some of that excuse. Josh, don't shake your head. You know it's true.
Did you watch the games? The Lakers totally game planned around making sure that Russell Westbrook got swung the ball with like 12 left in the shot clock, wide open to see what he would do. And most of the time, he either bricked a three or he dribbled into traffic and kicked the ball out. And then, you know, Harden had ISO again and he threw up a shitty shot.
No,
it totally game plan around just him catching it wide open, and he couldn't do anything with the ball. It was fun. It was very fun to watch for me as a hater.
I don't think they were expecting Russell Westbrook to have that many turnovers, though. Like, he's not that bad of a passer. He's not going to miss a wide open man at the wing consistently, okay? No, man. This was a different bad level of Westbrook. Like, this is an all-time low.
Yeah, and I think it would have been interesting where I was going to say, what if, like, I don't think the Rockets would have won if Westbrook didn't come back, but I wanted to see what Harden would have done if Russell Westbrook didn't come back and they still obviously had Daniel House. Like, would it have been more competitive or not?
I think it would have been more competitive, but meh, not really. Also, this Daniel House situation is just hilarious. Like, it's so wild to think that he was the guy who tried to almost blow up the bubble once the families were actually back in. Like, I don't get it whatsoever. But, you know, you do what you gotta do, Daniel House. Anything else for you guys? Or are we good here? Any final touches? Any last goodbyes to the Raptors?
I will be shocked if the Clippers lose, but it'll be entertaining to hear what happens with the Clippers if they do lose. So I'm excited for tomorrow. Probably one of the more exciting days in the bubble.
Yo, if they lose, we're coming on for an emergency pod. Yeah. If they lose, we're coming on to podcast at midnight, right?
Emergency pod, absolute.
Yeah, totally worth it. Josh, you don't work the next day. You'll be fine. All right, guys. I guess we'll call it here. I want to thank everyone for listening. Please remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes. We're on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, all the major podcast platforms. You can hit us up on Instagram and Twitter at Stretch4Pod. Until next time, peace.